Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 7th of December. David Margalek is our guest this hour, and he writes beautifully the story of Elizabeth and Hazel. If you go to our Facebook page, you'll see this iconic picture, which you will remember because it is a picture that we all remember from the Civil Rights Movement. Two Women of Little Rock is his book. And it is titled Elizabeth and Hazel, and it's the story behind one of the most iconic photos of the Civil Rights Movement. It was taken during the desegregation of Little Rock Central High School in 1957, and it not only talks about what happened those days, the violence that surrounded, the hate that surrounded, how incredibly difficult it was to prepare yourself as a black person to go to this school, and how the preparations that were made and why it was something that was so difficult for some of the white citizens of Little Rock. It had a dramatic impact on the individuals who were captured in this picture, on the people of Little Rock and many others in the years after this. The book takes that single moment, those two people, and it traces their stories over the next 50 years, including apologies that were made, including meeting each other, including telling this story to a national audience, and including having that story be an integral part of both of these young women's lives for all of their lives. We're going to speak with David this hour of the program. He's contributing editor at Vanity Fair, where he writes about culture and politics. He served as the national legal affairs editor at the New York Times and has written a number of books, including Strange Fruit, The Biography of a Song, Beyond Glory, Joe Lewis versus Max Schmeling, and A World on the Brink. And we'll be welcoming phone calls, which we always do. And here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Hi, David. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure,
Kathleen.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, what a beautifully written book this is. It just is just captivating. And why don't we start, I guess, in 1957 with these two young women, of course, starting with Elizabeth, and how she happened to be one of the nine black young students who were to attend the high school. How did she make the grade here?
Well, Elizabeth was a very studious young lady, and she was a person with ambitions, and she had been going, like all the black students, to a segregated high school when the opportunity arose to integrate Central High School. And she wanted to go because she wanted to go to college, and she wanted to be a lawyer, and there were courses at Central High School that weren't available at the smaller black school to which she'd been going. So this was an opportunity for her. And she managed to convince her parents, who were quite reluctant, to let her at least apply to go. And beyond that, it was rather fluky because the school administrators in Little Rock were determined to include as small a cohort of black students as they possibly could, which is why it was the Little Rock Nine. I mean, it doesn't sound so bad until you realize that there were 2,000 white students in that school, and only nine black students actually were chosen to get in. And Elizabeth was chosen, I think, rather haphazardly. She was really, as I say, she was ambitious. She was extremely sensitive and studious and bright. But she was also rather fragile, and I think that had somebody been choosing more carefully, they might have been more reluctant to have her among the pioneers. She was a very unlikely pioneer.
Mm. And isn't that a story that stays with her, that fragility, for all of her life, really?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the fragility, you know, first was cracked in a way in that picture, you know, the picture that's on the cover of the book and the picture that you mentioned, the iconic picture that everybody knows. I mean, the picture of the very stoical, dignified black girl in the white dress with the sunglasses walking in a mob with this white girl screaming behind her. Everybody knows this picture. And that was really only the beginning of her ordeal. I mean, the rest of the year in the school, which I describe, was really quite nightmarish. It was kind of anarchic. Anarchy reigned in the school. The school administrators essentially looked the other way and let a band of segregationist students run the place and torment all of the black students. And I think that none of them felt it more acutely than Elizabeth.
And it's so hard to read the first part of the book, her trip to school that first day, where unfortunately she doesn't get the phone call, so she has to go by herself to school, and this mob is around her, and the newspaper reporters are sort of, some of them slightly, trying to help her, and this woman sits on the bench with her, but they're yelling these incredibly awful epithets. She must have been worried she was going to be killed.
Well, it's really a heartbreaking story. And once you get to know her and you sort of subtract 40 or 50 years and realize what she must have been like as a 15-year-old girl, to have shown up there by herself and be subjected to the abuse that she got is really heartbreaking. And particularly, you know, as I describe, you know, she went to school that day with such high hopes. And that, you know, the skirt and blouse that she was wearing, she had made herself. It was the first day of school. And in her family, they all made their own clothes. And she had gotten, you know, she had gotten up early to look very pretty that day. And she had stayed up the night before and ironed the skirt to make it look extra special. And she had no idea what she was about to face. She knew there were soldiers around the school, but as she put it, she thought they were there to help her. You know, they were there to protect her and to escort her into the place. And she had no idea that they were going to lock bayonets whenever she tried to get in. So in addition to just the sheer abuse that she was subjected to was the shock. She had never experienced anything like that before. Who had?
Right.
You know, it's interesting that in segregated Little Rock, the whites and the blacks really didn't have that much to do with one another. So for her, this was kind of a crash course in racial reality of a sort that she had never had before.
Mm-hmm. And in some parts of the book, you write about, if you can, enlightened isn't quite the right word, but the racism in Arkansas was perhaps not as vicious as the racism in the deep South, Mississippi, Alabama.
That's right. I mean, Arkansas considered itself relatively enlightened. And the term that you always hear is, well, we're in, you know, Arkansas was not Mississippi. Mississippi was considered the archetypal racist place, you know, the place where racism and Jim Crow really reigned. And Arkansas was considered more Midwestern in a way, more Western than Southern. It was really the reason why the school system committed to desegregate before schools of the Deep South did. And I think that Little Rock was shocked to discover what it was really like. It didn't expect this, and it thought of itself as above all of this. And so there was a side to the community that the sort of more enlightened people in the community had never seen before. And then they promptly kind of abdicated their responsibilities. They didn't know what to do. And so they all looked the other way. Everybody looked the other way.
Mm-hmm. I love the attention that you paid in your description of Elizabeth's getting ready for school and the care that went into putting that beautiful outfit together, which we may add was never worn again. But Hazel, you also pay attention to how Hazel got dressed for school that day, which is equally as interesting.
Well, I think so. I mean, I think Hazel is a very interesting character. And, you know, everybody sees that girl in the picture. She was only 15 at the time that picture was taken. And everybody, you know, she looks much more grown up than that, and so she's judged accordingly. But she was only really a young girl when that picture was taken. And she, you know, she's interesting in her own way. And I tried very hard not to write this story from the standpoint of some self-righteous person in 2011 looking down on all of these primitives, and the story is much more complicated than that. The story of Hazel getting dressed that morning, of course, as you say, Kathleen, is very different. She wasn't wearing a homemade dress. She was wearing a dress that she had bought at the department store. Hazel was very social. It was a dress that she had worn to dances before and to school before. And she was really going to school to sort of get attention for herself and to get the attention of the boys and not to make some great political or racial statement. She wasn't a terribly political girl. She was kind of following what was going on with desegregation out of the corner of her eye, and she had heard her parents talk about it. But she hadn't gone down there that morning to make a protest. When she got there, she found that her friends were there in line, and she was kind of a ham, as she puts it, and she wanted to outdo them. So she's the one that's shouting louder than everybody else, and the one whose face is curled up in hatred. I mean, one of the interesting things is that one of the ringleaders of the segregationist students that year is standing next to her in the picture, but at the instant that it was taken, her father had called her, and she turned her head to look towards him, and so you can't see her face. And but for a quirk of history, you know, we might be talking about her instead of Hazel. But it was Hazel whose face was captured in that moment. And as you say, she's never lived that down. I mean, that picture has stalked her all her life. It will for the rest of her life. She's tried to atone for it for the rest of her life. And, you know, in her obituary, that picture will be at the top of it.
Yes.
There's no way that she'll ever escape that picture, as hard as she has tried to do that. And she realizes that.
At what point, David, did she decide that she was going to make a phone call to Elizabeth?
Well, this is, I think, one of the really interesting parts of the story, Kathleen, that you know, every writer likes to write, I think. We'd rather like the people we're writing about. And as I say, I mean, I'd never gone into this book with the idea that Hazel was represented entirely in that picture and that she hadn't devolved. And I was very heartened to learn, I think it's rather an extraordinary part of the story, that 5 years after the picture was taken, which would have been 1962 or 1963, I mean, the very fact that she can't remember exactly when it was is interesting. But she was a young mother by this point. She had dropped out of high school. She had never graduated from the high school she was so anxious to keep Elizabeth out of. And she had a couple of young boys running around the house. And she realized that at some point they were going to grow up and realize that they were going to learn in their history classes that that girl with the ugly face in that famous picture was their mother, and that she had some amends to make. She had some dues to pay. She had to sort of write things, and she'd also write things, R-I-G-H-T, write things. She lived alone in a trailer. Her husband was gone most of the time working in Memphis. So she had a lot of time to think to herself, and she was a curious girl, woman, young mother. She was sort of a self-taught. She had never gone to college, but she was interested in a lot of different things. And she was watching television and seeing the images of the fire hoses and the German shepherds attacking black protesters. And she realized that she had made her own contribution to this terrible climate in the South. And so she looked up Eckford, you know, Elizabeth Eckford's family in the phone book, and made the call to Elizabeth and got connected to her, and just got on the phone and said, "I just want you to know I'm the girl in the picture, and I want you to know how sorry I am." And I think that the beautiful part of that story is that, you know, this was 1962. Whites were not calling blacks at that point to apologize for anything. And she did it of her own volition. She didn't speak to her preacher or her husband or anybody before doing it. And I think most significantly, you know, it wasn't an Oprah Winfrey kind of public moment when cameras were rolling and it had all been stage managed. There was no one there. She did it on her own.
Right.
And she didn't do it to score points with anybody. No one knew about it for many, many years. So I think that, you know, that was a clue for me that was a sign of the kind of character that she had, and that was very important to me going forward.
Yes, yeah, she's an intriguing figure. Now that you brought up Oprah Winfrey, though, this is an interesting part of the story. I had no idea this happened. Tell us about the Oprah Winfrey, and there was more than one moment here, particularly the one where both women felt that they were ill-used on her show.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting. You know, we love things that are sort of counterintuitive.
Yes.
And one would assume, you know, that this whole story is counterintuitive in a way. Hazel is a very counterintuitive character. And one would have assumed that there'd be a kind of love-in at the Oprah Winfrey show.
Exactly,
I mean,
of all places.
We're jumping ahead a little bit in the sense that the listeners should know that in 1997, after having made that private apology many years earlier, on the 40th anniversary of the events in Little Rock, Hazel and Elizabeth had been photographed together by the same man who took the original picture. And it was a very public seeming reconciliation. Everybody was very excited about it. Little Rock had been maligned for many, many years. And their picture appeared on the front page of the Little Rock newspaper, standing around and smiling together. And it was promptly turned into a poster, and all of Little Rock, in a way, celebrated, because the feeling was that if these two people had come together and forgiven, you know, and if Elizabeth had forgiven Hazel and Hazel had grown, it must mean that Little Rock had also grown, and this town that had been denigrated around the world and ridiculed around the world as a symbol of racism had finally turned the corner. And so it's at this point that Elizabeth and Hazel start to hang around together. And this is another extraordinary part of the story. They discover that they actually like each other and that they have a lot in common. They're both very curious people. They're interested in history. They love to read books and go to secondhand bookstores. They take field trips together. They go to flower shows together. And they speak at schools together. And it was during this era that they go on Oprah Winfrey together. Oprah had a television show in 1999 devoted to the most famous photographs of the century. And this is clearly one of the most famous photographs of the century. I mean, it's clear that, to my mind, there's no picture, even from the civil rights era and all of the famous images from that, that so encapsulates racial hatred and the racial divide in this country. It's captured in Hazel's face. And so the picture is, you know, is that famous, and famous enough for Oprah to have a show around it and a few other famous pictures. And so she brings the two of them on the television program, and both Elizabeth and Hazel felt that Oprah was very disrespectful to them, that she kind of was dubious about their relationship and seemingly resentful that the two of them had made up and didn't quite believe it. And so she treated them rather peremptorily. And it's interesting because at this point, Elizabeth, this was around the point where I met Elizabeth and Hazel, and it was around this point that the two of them started to draw apart. I mean, it might have been that in fairness even to Oprah, I don't think Oprah picked up any animosity or static between Elizabeth and Hazel that day, but subliminally, the two of them were having problems with one another. And it was ironic that, you know, one of the few things that they were really agreeing about at that point was that Oprah was rude to each of them.
Hmm. We're going to take phone calls for you, David, and we'll do it in a moment. David Margalek is our guest. His latest book is just really a fascinating read, Elizabeth and Hazel, Two Women of Little Rock. It's the picture, you'll be familiar as he described it. It's one of the most famous photographs of the century, and it captures that moment when Elizabeth is attempting to get to school, the desegregation of Little Rock Central High School in 1957, and the horrendous day that was. Not only a day, it extended into her time at the school too, and it affected the lives of both women, and also captures the photo of Hazel, who is the white 15-year-old who is behind her, and her face is just contorted, filled with anger, shouting horrendous, along with a crowd who's all surrounding the streets and also shouting all of these epithets at Elizabeth. Elizabeth and Hazel, Two Women of Little Rock is the name of the book. And here's our phone number. We'll go to your calls momentarily, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. David Margalek, author of Elizabeth and Hazel, Two Women of Little Rock, is our guest this hour. Yeah, he spent a long time, a dozen years of research, including many conversations with the women in this book. And the book looks at that day, what led up to that day, and the paths that the women took after that day, and the improbability of a friendship, which didn't continue, but the important thing is how that time defined really their whole lives. 800-486-8655 is our number. Eugene and Viola, hi.
Good morning, Kathleen. In winter of 1991-92, I hooked up with an outfit to plant trees down south. And they put me on a crew in Louisiana. And not too far from Goldana. Well, one afternoon it was raining and we couldn't set or couldn't plant. So I drove into Goldana and I stopped in the garage and I was talking to a black man. I was asking some directions. And a white man chimed in. And the black automatically closed his mouth and never said another word. And I thought, Lordy, things haven't changed. And I got my directions and I moved on. But I found out afterwards Goldana was the headquarters of the KKK. And that was 20 years ago.
Have things changed, David?
Well, I think that things have changed superficially for sure. I mean, Little Rock looks very, very different from the way that it did in Elizabeth's day, and Central High School is, you know, more than 50% black, and you know, there are many black local officers and black policemen and black office holders and all of that. And I think that the racial tension has just sort of gone underground, but I think it definitely still exists. And even in the misunderstandings that arose between Elizabeth and Hazel after they stopped seeing one another and stopped talking to another, you can feel it there. I mean, that's a complicated story, and it's one of the reasons that it took me so long to write the book. Elizabeth and Hazel have not spoken to one another for the last 10 years, and yet I became sort of an intermediary between the two of them. I tried very hard not to become a character in my own book, but it is interesting that since my book appeared, Elizabeth has written a letter to Hazel apologizing for some of the things that she has said. And there is sort of some movement between the two of them. I don't exactly know how it's going to turn out. But, you know, the relationship between these two women is very deep. It's not only historic, it's sort of ongoing. And it isn't over yet. So these things are very, very complicated. I don't doubt the experience that this gentleman had. And I think that, you know, you don't have to be down there for very long to feel something like that, even in an episode at a gas station.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Eugene, for your call. Paul in Racine. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Thanks for the show. I remember reading about the book, and I look forward to actually reading it, and so I'm interested to hear your guests speak about the power of one image, and I would like to hear some more thoughts about his thoughts on the captured image, you know, and if he sees, you know, any other images historically or currently that, you know, we might be dissecting 40, 50 years from now, much like he has dissected this one image and everything that went into it.
Mm. Well, I think, Paul, that there are a lot of pictures that lend themselves to this sort of thing. I was a reporter on the New York Times for many years, and I once did a piece about the photograph of the little boy in the Warsaw ghetto with his hands up, you know, being rousted out of hiding, the little boy with the cap, and it's a very, very famous picture. The German soldiers are around, and that's another one. I mean, in fact, there has since been a book written about that picture, and I think there are a lot, I think that there is something uniquely powerful about an image frozen in time. And, you know, this was just a momentary thing. In fact, one of Hazel's points is that a life is more than a moment and that it's not fair to judge somebody from what somebody did in a 60th of a second. But in fact, there's no, as I say, there's no escaping that. And I minutely focused on this picture. I mean, I interviewed the photographer, a fellow named Will Counts, a lovely man who has since died, who was the photographer for the Little Rock paper. He was 26 years old when he took the picture. And I tried to find everybody that I could who was in the picture. I placed an ad in the Little Rock paper looking for people. I managed to identify some of them. I mean, there's another picture. There's a very famous picture, for instance, of a lynching in southern Indiana that's often reprinted, a horrific picture that one could easily write an entire book about. The pictures that were taken in the Dust Bowl during the Depression, you know, where you can photograph the sharecroppers and their children, and you can trace what happened to the children. In pictures like that, you know, you can trace the history of America. You know, those kids are now middle class kids with cars and, you know, homes of their own. And so I think that it's a style of research that I've liked to do. I mean, one of the other, I wrote a book about one song that Billie Holiday did, and, you know, all kinds of themes radiate out from this one song: the person who wrote the song, the subject matter of the song, the reactions to the song. It was a political song, it was an anti-lynching song. Similarly, I wrote a book about one prize fight that lasted 2 minutes and 4 seconds, the Lewis Schmeling fight. So it's kind of neat to put a microscope on something and magnify it and scrutinize it, and you can read all sorts of things into it. And I just should say that, you know, as long as I'm speaking on Wisconsin Public Radio, that this is the kind of the tradition that I associate with Wisconsin. I once did a story for the Times about Willard Hearst, the late legal historian at the University of Wisconsin Law School. And there's this whole history of sort of people's history coming out of Wisconsin and studying the real lives of people, and that's what this picture offered me an opportunity to do. So it's a privilege to be speaking to the people of Wisconsin about something like this.
Thank you, David. That's nice.
Yeah, well, yeah. It's an incredibly proud tradition that the University of Wisconsin represents. So I'm very mindful of that.
Thank you, Paul, so much for your call. As long as we're talking about the picture, I was, because we're members of the press here, interested in John Chancellor being there, a very young man who was covering this, how television covered this, and how other newspapers, northern newspapers, picked up on the story, and an ad that was run by a gentleman, I can't remember his name, from Little Rock. That's all fascinating.
Well,
too,
that's
Dave.
An amazing story. I mean, that's one of these serendipitous things that happens when you're writing a book. There was an ad in the Little Rock paper. There were two Little Rock papers back then, one progressive and one quite reactionary. And in the progressive paper, somebody reprinted the photograph and said, if you live in Arkansas, study this picture and no shame. K-N-O-W, no shame.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, and the guy's name was printed in tiny type at the bottom of the picture. And it's interesting that the local paper deigned to reprint that ad, because the other paper never would have done it. That was the first thing. And secondly, who was this man, and what moved him to put his money down and to place that ad? And I did a lot of interesting research on him and found out his whole story and how he'd been overseas during the war and had been in German towns where everybody professed not to know what happened to the Jews. And he said, you know, this kind of indifference to history is a very poisonous thing, and I wanted to call people's attention to this picture. So there's a chapter on him in the book. There are a lot of interesting digressions that you can make when you do a book like this.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'll bet there are tons and tons. I also love the Louis Armstrong digression.
Yeah, that's another one, because Louis Armstrong, I mean, you mentioned about television, and I think that television was still very much in its infancy, and television news was in its infancy in 1957. The evening news show was only 15 minutes long. I think the major impact was from the still photography rather than television, as it would have been now, because the picture ran all over the world and embarrassed America all over the world. And one of the people who saw the picture was Louis Armstrong, you know, genial, amiable Louis Armstrong, who was very apolitical. Apolitical in the sense that he didn't speak out on political issues. Political in the sense that he was breaking down barriers everywhere in his own way. He was the first black to do any number of things. But he saw the picture, and he was very upset by it, and he spoke out about it to a young university student who was the stringer for a local paper in North Dakota. And Louis Armstrong's comments reverberated around the world. Louis Armstrong said, you know, I feel as if I don't have a country anymore. And he said, you know, they're asking me to, you know, to be a goodwill ambassador and to travel to the Soviet Union. And how can I do that when my country is treating my own people this way? And when Louis Armstrong said something like that, it resonated.
And you're not even really saying on the air what Louis Armstrong said,
no,
because
well,
you
listen,
can't say it.
The FCC is listening.
Exactly.
And this is NPR, and
exactly.
You know, and people are very polite. But Louis Armstrong was
he was mad.
Was extremely angry, mm-hmm. And yeah, he spoke in one of George Carlin's words.
Yeah, Mike in South Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I think it's really coincidental that the author just used the word poisonous a few. Minutes ago, because as I was listening to this show, what strikes me is that these two teenage girls were put in a position of hating each other for reasons that had nothing to do with their own behavior because of the poison of the past and the action of the powerful in the past importing slaves to this country. And I think we see this in other photographs like Kent State, the girl standing over the fallen student, the napalm kid in Vietnam, and I like the author to reflect on the poison of the past, and aren't we now experiencing a time in our country where we're starting to see, again, the poison of the past, or maybe it's the poison of the present.
I think it's a good point that talk is cheap, and I think that particularly on talk radio now, there's a lot of hatred being spewed. And this and these comments have consequences, and it's a pity that it's a blessing that our airwaves are so open, but what comes with that is a certain sense of responsibility, and it's violated regularly. I would only amend the caller's comments to say that in some ways, if you look at that picture, and you know, I was trying to say before that anybody plugging Elizabeth Eckford into Google Images can see the picture in case you can't conjure it up. Or if you look up Elizabeth and Hazel on Amazon, you'll see the picture. It's on the cover of the book. But the poison went one way. It's unfair in a way to characterize the poison as going both ways. Elizabeth is walking with great dignity and stoicism that day. Her face is not filled with hatred. There was a great disproportion in power. She was the only black girl on the scene at that moment. And she's just trying at that point, having been rebuffed at the school, to get to a bus stop mm-hmm. where she feels she'll be treated safely and she'll have a little bit of protection sitting at a bus stop. The hatred was coming from only the white community at that moment. The hatred was not going in both directions. I mean, it may now and it may in other contexts, but that's a picture of the disproportionate power between blacks and whites in this country in 1957. The whites had all the power, and they have all the power in that picture.
Oh, do they ever. Let's spend a little more time, because there are so many elements of sadness about Elizabeth's life that I get the feeling, David, that she never really had any kind of soulmate. She didn't have anybody to talk to. She didn't have any friends. Her mom was mentally ill, discovered later. She had problems in colleges that she went to. She was... It really wasn't part of a unit with the nine who were doing all these appearances. She was there, but she wasn't fully there. There's this sense of being alone with her.
I think that's a very keen point, and I think that her life has been a life of great isolation and sadness. And, you know, I point out in the book that she tried to kill herself a couple of times. She never married. She had two children by men whom she never married. There's tragedy with one of her sons, which I describe in the book. And I think that at a certain point, through great courage and also by better medical treatment, she pulls herself out of her lifelong funk. She was depressed. She was on disability after serving in the Army. And she was really out of commission for many years. And in the 90s, she sort of pulls herself up And it's rather an extraordinary story and a great turnaround. And she gets her first job in 30 years. She becomes a probation officer for a local judge, a black judge, who takes a great risk with her. And he does it because he feels, as he told me, that he owed her. He was from the next generation. And he said, I owed this woman a great debt of gratitude because she paved the way for me. And I felt the community had not paid her back. And she became a probation officer, and she's turned her life around, and she's become, you know, when she first started to give public addresses, when she spoke to schools and public groups, she would have a wastebasket next to her lined with a hefty bag in case she got sick in the middle of whatever she was saying. She was so petrified of public speaking. And now she's become a great eyewitness. She's a witness to history. And when people start talking about how things were never that bad, and, you know, the Little Rock Nine were exaggerating how bad things were in the school and all of that, you know, overlooking how all the white kids would leave the shower simultaneously and flush the toilet so that Elizabeth would get scalded, you know, and shove her into the locker and knock her down the stairs and knock the books out of her hand and everything. And when there are people who say now things were not that bad and most of us were nice to the black kids, she's there as a witness to say that's absolutely not true.
Yes.
And part of her renaissance, and this is one of the things that she said in her letter to Hazel, written about a month ago, was that Hazel, this is one of the wonderful twists in the story, was that Hazel and Hazel's encouragement was one of the things that helped her come back to life and flower again. And so this is the bond between them, and it remains very profound. And as I say, even though they haven't spoken to one another, when I asked them about one another, they both teared up. I mean, it's clear that they're stubborn and they're proud, but there's still a very profound bond between the two of them.
David Margolick is our guest. His book is Elizabeth and Hazel, Two Women of Little Rock. More phone calls momentarily. A line is open if you'd like to join us. 800-486-8655 is the number. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If I haven't said this before, I do want to let you know that this picture, along with a comment from David about the picture, is on our Facebook page. So you don't want to go through this whole hour without referencing this iconic picture, and that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. And you can write your comments there, too, about all of the shows that we do, because it's a place to talk about the show after the show. Let's go to Jerry Ann in South Milwaukee. Hi, Jerry Ann.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
I just an observation. I grew up in the South, Richmond, Virginia, and was about the same age as Elizabeth and Hazel, and was very aware of the civil rights activity going on then, but I didn't feel like I was as much of a racist as the people around me, and I think that was tempered by the fact that my husband was in the Air Force, so we lived in a more integrated society after I became an adult. But I really kind of prided myself on not being a racist and so forth. And I ended up working for the Los Angeles court system, and a contingent of judges and court officials went to a museum in Los Angeles that was dedicated primarily to the Holocaust. It was about intolerance. But there was a small exhibit of the civil rights movement, which really captured my attention because I think I identified with it far more, and was just struck by things that I hadn't realized before, the dignity and the discipline of the people who were involved in that. The tour to the museum ended with what we were told was a surprise, and it turned out to be a talk by one of the Little Rock Nine, Terry Robbins. He described a great deal of what Elizabeth talks about, the unbelievable torture that the students underwent. And then later on, he talked about going back to a reunion. He wasn't too sure he wanted to do it, but he ended up going. And one of his chief tormentors talked about the good times and what good buddies they were.
He's an interesting guy, Terence Roberts. He's a man of great intelligence and dignity. And I think, I mean, none of them had an easy time of it, but he had a way of walking through that school with great dignity, and he's recently written a book about his own experiences in Little Rock.
Hmm.
I live in South Milwaukee now, but recently had an opportunity to meet many of the members of the Little Rock Nine when they were honored by Marquette University.
Yes, that was recent.
Such a thrill for me, and my daughter gave me a picture that was autographed by many of them, which is hanging on my wall right here. And I also, I'm not really sure, but I might have met David during the O.J. Simpson trial in Los Angeles. I was the media liaison there, and a number of people from the New York Times and other East Coast newspapers covered that trial.
Oh, that's very funny. I remember you, Jerry Ann.
Oh, my gosh.
I remember you. And I don't hold it against you that you bumped me from the first row to the third row when I didn't show up.
It was horrible. You know, I know what King Solomon.
That's very
like.
Funny. Well, it's nice to hear your voice again.
Thank you, David.
Thanks.
Best wishes on the book.
Thank you.
I am gonna get it.
Yeah, thank you so much.
It's worthwhile. Ah, this tiny little world.
That,
I love those
really
connections.
That's
I
really
love
amazing.
Them. Yeah, we should talk a little bit more too about Elizabeth's. Elizabeth's life, but first I want to get back to this, why this, these acts that took place, you know, rocks and snowballs that were thrown at these young kids and the horrible acts of violence. You do write in the book that there were, 2,000 students at this school, and yet this small band of virulent racists were allowed to dictate all the things that happened in the shower, in the locker room, going home from school, et cetera. Why would an administration put up with that?
Well, I think that the administration was walking a very fine line. They didn't want to antagonize the community, and they didn't. They felt that the political situation was very, very fragile, and they didn't want to stick their necks out for the blacks. I think it was easier for them, and I think also that some of the administrators, particularly the high school principal, were in a way sympathetic to the segregationists. I mean, there are quotes in the book where they say, you know, we don't like this any more than you do. And so I think that they just pretended that it wasn't happening.
Thanks, Jerry Ann, for the call. Suzanne in Spirit. Hi.
Hi, thank you. You know, as the wife and the mother of a family that were new to Wisconsin in 1998, therefore we were outsiders, and whose home was burned to the ground mysteriously on Martin Luther King Jr. Day 2006, if you Google the KKK in Wisconsin, USA, you get some information about Professor Commons in the 1920s of the University of Wisconsin, with his racist policies that have infected Wisconsin culture to this day.
Your house was burned down, Suzanne?
Yes, ma'am. One day before, my husband and my son were to face heinous felony charges that 5 years later came to nothing.
And what's the race element? Are you a family of color?
Hatred, ma'am. It's nativism. It's outsiders. It's someone who doesn't have no family or relatives in the area, who come in as niche organic farmers in an area where they've for 50 years been dairy farmers and loggers, and they see us as tree huggers. I didn't even know it was a bad term. Anarchist trouble.
All right, but was there an element of race involved in this, Suzanne?
No.
No. All right. So, but she sees a parallel being outsiders. Can we go that far?
Of course, the great irony is that, you know, blacks have been in this country longer than whites. So in that sense, there was no outsider element at all. I mean, the blacks of Little Rock had been there from the beginning, you know. I mean, in that sense, there's a distinction between these two situations, although I guess xenophobia is xenophobia.
Yeah. And thanks very much for the call. The other thing that happened, I guess I wasn't really aware of this, is that this group, the Little Rock Nine, really marked the anniversary of this event year after year. It was a huge thing in this country. The picture was a huge thing. The movement was huge. And so they were destined to repeat the story for all of their lives. It's not over.
But, you know, you made a good point before, which is that I think that whites generally tend to assume that they lump blacks together and assume that the Little Rock Nine were all this incredibly cohesive group. And in fact, they were nine very distinct individuals, Elizabeth being one of the more distinctive among them. And they weren't all that close. And they've become closer over the years as they've marked all these anniversaries. But, you know, historically, they're a very, very different group of people. And I think also, as long as you're mentioning all the anniversaries, that one of the things that Elizabeth has faced and that the Little Rock Nine has faced is that quietly, subliminally, for any white reporter who's writing about this and talking to whites in Little Rock for a book like this, there's great Little Rock Nine fatigue. Everybody's sick of them.
Uh-huh.
Everybody is tired of these commemorations and think, why can't we all just put this behind us?
Uh-huh.
Hasn't enough time passed? And there's great resentment that this picture, you know, is so prominently displayed in the Central High School Museum, the Visitor Center in Little Rock. It's the first thing that you see. And it's one of the reasons why Hazel is so bitter, because Hazel has gotten flack from everybody. Hazel is one of the only people who came forward and ever apologized. And she found that blacks resented her. Blacks thought that she was a hypocrite or was an exploiter, somebody who was a self-publicist, somebody who was trying to make some dough. Where had she been all of these years? Even other people in the Little Rock Nine resented her. And then whites resented her. Whites resented her because they felt that she gave all of them a bad name, that they hadn't been bad people. They might not have stood up for the blacks who were in Central High School, but they didn't do anything wrong. They weren't the ones that were spreading shards of glass on the shower room floor. They were just normal high school kids. And here's Hazel, and here's this picture, and it won't go away. And here she is calling attention to herself and embarrassing all of them. And so one of the problems that I've had in publicizing this book is that Hazel won't do any television. Hazel says, I spoke to you. I said this would be the last time I would ever tell my story, and I'm not going to do it again because I've learned my lesson that coming forward and apologizing is not worth it. And the people who never apologized and the people who made all of this trouble all that time for the blacks in Little Rock and never said anything and lived their lives and had their children and their grandchildren, never suffered a moment's discomfort for whatever they did.
Right. I see your point. And it made me look, as you were just saying that, at the picture, which I do have in front of me, of all the other people who are surrounding Hazel.
Yeah.
That they all did do something wrong. I mean,
yeah.
they all did. They didn't do a darn thing. They didn't help her. They just said these horrible things to her. She was all by herself, and they
Hazel,
all did something
wrong.
Hazel,
as I said, has spent her life atoning.
Right.
And she worked, you know, she worked with underprivileged kids in Little Rock, and she counseled unwed black mothers in Little Rock, and she read up on black history, and she's tried to lead a righteous life. And, you know, I think that it's a pity that she feels the way that she does, and I'm hoping that, you know, as people read the book and check in with her and say, you know, I never realized that your story is
mm-hmm.
more complex and that you're not just the girl in that picture, that she's gratified and that she's reassured that people realize that, you know,
people
as
change.
She says, that her life was not
right.
just that one moment.
Yeah. No, that is an inspirational part of her story, no doubt.
I think both of them are very inspirational figures. I ended up admiring both of them enormously.
Yeah. Art in Milwaukee, we have about a minute left. Hi, Art.
Hi. We had a very influential person in Milwaukee named Joe Winston, who was head of Northcutt Neighborhood House, other things. He was from Little Rock, and he had told us that he was originally going to be part of the group that would integrate this high school, except that his parents or grandparents sort of had second thoughts. I'm just wondering if the name of Joe Winston has ever come up to your...
It hasn't come up, but I do know that there were a lot of black families that were afraid to send their kids to Central High School that year. The white administrators didn't want a lot of black students there, and a lot of blacks opted out themselves. And so that's why there were only 9 of them.
Mm-hmm. You can see why. If you were in that situation, wouldn't you have a hard time sending your child into danger?
Well, I think that the parents were incredibly courageous.
They sure were.
And they didn't have a clue of what was really going on. I mean, mm-hmm. Elizabeth never told her parents what was happening because had she was afraid she would have been withdrawn immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And she wanted to stay there.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Art, very much for the call. Well, David, thank you so much for being with us and for writing the book. I feel like we almost can't do it justice because it's so poetic that people need to read it, too, in addition to talking about it.
Thank you for having me and for going over it so conscientiously. It's such a pleasure.
Thank you, David. David Margolick, you spell his last name Margolick. The book is Elizabeth and Hazel, Two Women of Little Rock. You can see the picture that prompted all of this and prompted his book on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. It is the picture of Elizabeth and Hazel taken on that day in 1957 as Elizabeth is attempting to be part of the desegregation process of Little Rock Central High School. And this is that day and all that ensued in the many years after. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy as well for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Thanks for listening. Great conversations ahead. We'll be with you tomorrow again at 9 o'clock.